The U.S. Supreme Court decided earlier this week that Arizona's independent redistricting commission is constitutional. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with the commission's chair, independent Colleen Coyle Mathis, about the ruling, its impact, and her thoughts on the perception of the commission. And political scientist Fred Solop will discuss what this means for elections going forward. Could Arizona actually turn purple? Also, another Supreme Court decision legalized same-sex marriage, but it hasn't eliminated LGBT discrimination. What's the next step? Plus, Maricopa County has a well-known sheriff who's often making headlines and who some would like to see retire. Pima County has a longtime sheriff who has decided to retire at the end of this month. I'll talk with Sheriff Clarence Dupnik about his career, changes he's seen in law enforcement, and the aftermath of the January 2011 Tucson shootings. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S. and Cuba are marking another milestone in their new relationship following decades of rivalry. President Obama says both nations have agreed to open embassies in their respective capitals. Now that the U.S. Supreme Court is upholding key provisions of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama is expected to be more blunt in his message about the kinds of health care initiatives that he believes states ought to adopt. NPR Scott Horsley says the president is taking his message on Obamacare to Tennessee this hour.
President Obama says his signature health care law has already extended insurance coverage to some 16 million Americans. And he argues it could do even more.
The results, I think, speak for themselves. We have the lowest uninsured rate that we have since we started keeping records. It's worked better, cost less than even supporters anticipated.
Tennessee is one of 19 states that opted not to expand Medicaid under the health care law. The state's Republican governor pushed for expansion, but he was rebuffed by the Tennessee legislature. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
Eurozone governments and institutions are considering a new offer made by the Greek government in its search for financial assistance a day after Athens defaulted on an IMF payment. Terry Schultz reports from Brussels that Eurozone partners are trying to keep Greece inside their currency union and still get Athens to accept more difficult reforms.
Germany says Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras's Tuesday offer isn't sufficiently changed from his previous positions. Chancellor Angela Merkel says she's not willing to negotiate anyway until after a referendum on bailout conditions the Greek government maintains will be held Sunday. French President François Hollande, meanwhile, wants a deal as soon as possible to minimize financial turmoil. In Brussels, European Commission Vice President Valdis Dombrovskis expressed continued solidarity.
We stand by the Greek people and the doors for negotiations are open.
Despite his request, Prime Minister Tsipras is still calling on Greeks to reject EU bailout conditions when they vote Sunday. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Just months after becoming the first woman appointed to the highest ranks of Toyota, Julie Hamp is now out of a job. She has tendered her resignation and Toyota has accepted after the public relations chief was arrested last month on suspicion that she was trying to smuggle in oxycodone, a strictly controlled drug in Japan. Well, Hamp denies she intentionally broke the law. Another black church once targeted by the Ku Klux Klan is in ruin because of a fire, but federal authorities say they're not so sure it was intentional. However, they're still investigating. The fire broke out overnight at the Mount Zion African Methodist Episcopal Church in Greeleyville, about 50 miles north of Charleston, where a pastor and eight members of a historic black church were murdered weeks ago. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fifth Generation Incorporated, maker of Tito's Handmade Vodka. Since 1995, distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas by Tito Beverage. American-made and gluten-free. Recipes and more at titosvodka.com.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. 2 years ago Tuesday, the Yarnell Hill Fire killed 19 firefighters, making it the deadliest blaze in state history. And as KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports, the Arizona State Parks Department marked the solemn anniversary by purchasing the land where they died for a future memorial park.
It'll be called the Granite Mountain Hotshots Memorial State Park, and now its site is secure. Arizona State Parks Director Sue Black was the sole bidder in the land's auction. She says about 100 people came to the event.
Seeing the faces of the families and the comments from them was just a memory I'll have for the rest of my life. So I was glad to be a part of it and was thankful I had the opportunity to be a catalyst to get the project going.
The land was purchased for just over $300,000. Black says the design and budget have not been decided on yet, and she doesn't know when the project will be complete, but would love to see it open in a year. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Gila River Indian community is filing suit to block a proposed freeway that borders its community on the south side of the valley. The tribe is challenging the decision by federal highway officials to approve the route of the South Mountain Freeway through what the tribe calls sacred land.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Kathy Ritchie. The city of Tucson is launching a free GED testing program at Pima Community College. The high school equivalency test typically costs $140, but city leaders think the cost is too high and can become a barrier. The free testing was made possible by a donation from Wells Fargo. GED recipients in Tucson earn about $7,000 more per year than people without a high school diploma, according to the U.S. Census Bureau.
We'll see partly sunny skies today in the valley, high near 105 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, ranked the top cancer hospital in Arizona by U.S. News & World Report. Learn more at mayoclinic.org/cancer.
Right now, under partly sunny skies, it's 94 degrees in the valley at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, the Supreme Court has upheld the constitutionality of Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission. What does that say about the maps that were drawn, and how could it affect election outcomes going forward? I'll talk with Commission Chair Colleen Coyle Mathis and political scientist Fred Solop. The High Court also ruled on same-sex marriage, making it legal in all 50 states. But LGBT activists say that decision didn't solve the discrimination problems that remain. I'll ask Madeline Edelman about what's next. And Maricopa County Prosecutor Juan Martinez has been involved in some hot-button cases, and Phoenix Magazine has a profile of Martinez in its July issue. I'll ask writer Paul Rubin for his impressions of Martinez. We start today's program with a longtime Arizona sheriff who'll be retiring at the end of this month. It's not the one in Maricopa County because he's already planning to run again for re-election. The one we're talking about is the sheriff of Pima County, Clarence Dupnik, and the sheriff joins me now. Sheriff, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So, you've been elected 9 times. Why retire now?
Well, people are starting to call me Strom.
There is a little bit of a resemblance there, slightly. Slightly.
Yeah, that's true.
But, are you ready to go? Are you feeling like you've done enough and it's a good time to go? Do you feel like you're slipping at all? Can I ask that?
If I really was going to do what I wanted to do, I would stay. But I just think that it's time for me to go and get some new blood in here and time for Cosmo the Pollock to move on.
Why did you want to be in law enforcement in the first place? I mean, this is not just, you've been sheriff for 35 years, but you were in law enforcement long before that. What were your goals when you started?
Well, I never wanted to be a cop. I was going to the University of Arizona and playing baseball, and I wanted to be a baseball player, but I learned after my first year there that I wasn't fast enough, I wasn't big enough, I couldn't throw hard enough. I was a decent hitter, but baseball wasn't going to be a career for me that I could make any money at. And I ran out of money, and I needed a job, and I found out that the police department was hiring, and I went down, and by George, they hired me.
Well, it was obviously the right call for you, but did you feel like you stuck with it because you were good at it, you were making an impact, or it just became a career for you?
Let me tell you, I just have loved every minute of the last 57 years. There's something about law enforcement that's very challenging and competitive and rewarding, and all of those things are good.
What are some of the differences between being at the county level as opposed to the city level? Because the city officers will often talk about the relationships they can make sort of walking through neighborhoods. When you're in a county situation, you're covering a lot more land. What are some of the differences there?
Well, let me tell you, when I left the Tucson Police Department after 20 years, I was in charge of field operations. And people ask me this question all the time. You know, how could you become a politician and put up with all the nonsense that goes along with politics when you were nothing but a professional over at the city? And what I tell them, they don't believe, really. But there's more politics involved in city police departments And I shouldn't include all sheriff's departments because some sheriff's departments have sheriffs that are much different. But I was always responding to complaints and requests from city council members and mayors and city managers and so on and so forth all the time. As a sheriff here, I don't have to do that. As a matter of fact, I think the Board of Supervisors is very happy when they get complaints about our service. They say, call the sheriff. And the only political stuff I have to do is campaigning, which I hate. I can't imagine that any normal person would enjoy campaigning, going out and begging for money.
Yeah.
I think the most I've ever raised is $35,000, and I hear some people raise as much as $6 million.
We have a person who's sheriff, up here, who may have done something like that. Do you have any quick impressions about the sheriff of Maricopa County?
Hey, you know, let me tell you, I've known Joe for many, many years. I knew him way before he was a sheriff. And I always had a good relationship with him. You know, when he became sheriff, for some reason, he took off in a different direction. And that's about all. I still like Joe.
It's Here and Now in KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with the retiring sheriff of Pima County, Clarence Dupnik. He's been in that job for 35 years. Sheriff, is there more animosity toward law enforcement now? We're hearing a lot of high-profile cases around the country. Do you feel like that is the case, or we're just hearing more about it?
No, I think there's more animosity, and I'll tell you why I think that is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because of basically cable news networks.
Mm.
I think they have divided this country significantly. They have fostered antagonism towards government, towards elected officials, towards people in the other party, towards anybody who doesn't believe like they believe. And this has been going on for a number of years, and now we're at the point where we've lost all, and I shouldn't say we, but especially people back in Washington, and I think some of it goes on in Phoenix too, elect people that don't have America's best interests at heart. For the last 8 years, a large number of people and a large number of legislators have done nothing but try to make our president look bad, even if they do things that hurt our country. And if there's ever going to be an end to this, I hope it's in the near future, but I don't expect it in my lifetime.
You were not shy after in the aftermath of the horrible shootings in January of 2011, saying certain things about, I think, sort of the direction you were just going there. Do you think there have been changes in that direction? Do you think outside of the cable news, do you think people are listening to each other more with open ears? Do you think there are more civil discussions going on, or no?
I don't really think so, except that what's happened in South Carolina, all of a sudden, people are afraid, for whatever reason, to be as obnoxious as they have in the past with one another and things like the Confederate flag and so forth. But I think a lot of this started against cops with Ferguson. And I blame cable TV for what occurred with, you know, the hands up. All of a sudden, hands up, and it was a bunch of crap. The truth was hidden for several weeks. And, you know, I think Ferguson Police Department is largely responsible for a lot of that because they weren't defending themselves or putting out what they knew was the truth until much later. But by then, the whole universe had been contaminated against that poor cop in Ferguson. In my opinion, he was just doing his job. But that's not the way the public saw it, and the reason is because I think of cable network.
Now, in Tucson, there are a lot of dealings you would have with people of color. It's a very diverse area. Pima County, in general, is a diverse area. Do you feel like your department has a good relationship with people of color?
Let me tell you, we have a very good relationship with everybody, but we have a very low percentage of African Americans. We have a very, very high percentage of Mexican Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's same is probably true in Phoenix.
And do you feel like there is a good community relationship there then with Mexican-Americans?
I think we have an excellent relationship with Mexican-Americans. And I think most of the cities have a pretty good relationship with Mexican-Americans.
Sheriff, just a couple of minutes left. Let's go to law enforcement more generally. What do you think of some of the high-tech developments, including body cameras? Are those good developments or no?
Well, the body cameras, in my judgment, have a ways to go yet before you can really make a value judgment on whether they're good or bad. One of the things that is not coming out, we are doing a pilot study, and the things that we've learned, we simply couldn't afford to do them because you can get, we would have to keep them stored for almost a lifetime, and we don't have the storage space, we don't have the money to do that, and because the public can request to view any of that stuff at any time. And one of the things that concerns me, and I know the media is going to not agree with me, but I think there's too much access to personal and private information, especially if you're a public official. And I don't have any problem with the cameras from the standpoint of using them and seeing what's going on. As a matter of fact, I think a lot of departments feel that they are beneficial when they're getting complaints.
Sheriff, one last question for you, and this is sort of a broader sense, but there's been an expansion of the private prison systems in Arizona. Do you think the county jails can handle these things? Do you have concerns about private prisons?
I have concerns about private prisons, but not for the overcrowding reason. We have a very backward, in my approach, stupid approach to how we deal with prisoners, period. The law is that we keep people in jail for years and years and years on offenses which are not murder or rape or robbery, but narcotics and what have you. It just doesn't make sense to keep those people in prisons for years and years and years. Arizona is worse than most of the states when it comes to the amount of people that we keep in our prisons and jails. And the United States is by far the biggest prison housing country in the world. And I just think that it doesn't make a lot of sense. But people have this attitude that, you know, these people ought to be locked up and the key thrown away. And people get elected based on catering to that philosophy. And they wind up passing laws that I think are onerous and stupid. I think that we ought to do a study, a very lengthy study on who we put in prison and why and for how long.
Clarence Dupnik is the sheriff of Pima County, has been for 35 years. He's retiring at the end of this month. Sheriff, great to talk with you. Thanks for the time.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In its just completed term, the Supreme Court ruled on some very controversial issues, including same-sex marriage and the Affordable Care Act. And with the presidential race already including nearly 20 candidates, we're bound to see nasty comments and insults hurled from all directions. But what about civil conversations and an exchange of ideas? Where will those come from? With me now to talk about that for a few minutes is Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer, Executive Director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, which is headquartered at the U of A in Tucson. Dr. Lukensmeyer, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
What sort of progress have you seen when it comes to civil discourse in the public square? And I guess as sort of an add-on to that, how would you define what civil discourse is?
Well, Steve, we spent a lot of time really both talking with people about how they see what civil discourse is, looking at it academically through history. And, you know, it's very interesting. It comes down to just a couple of things. It is the capacity to listen respectfully to points of view that are different than your own, so that you're in a conversation, you can agree, you can even be very emotional about the disagreement, but the bottom line is you respect the other person's right to have a viewpoint different than your own. What people are reacting so negatively to is the amount of our public discourse that is absolutism. If you don't believe what I believe, somehow you are not as good a person as I am, or somehow there's something wrong with how you think about this. So the public really understands what it means, the difference between being civil and uncivil. And they also really understand that one of the things that's great about American democracy is this space to argue freely about what you believe in. But we don't have to do character assassination, and we don't have to shut out people who think differently than we do.
So when you see the passionate people in front of the Supreme Court, for example, related to same-sex marriage, let's say, holding their signs, addressing each other, sometimes very impolitely, what are your thoughts about that when things seem so visceral? Is it possible to have civil discourse in that? As you mentioned, people can be very passionate.
Well, you're picking a very immediate and beautiful example of the actions that people take at moments of high advocacy. You know, on that issue of gay marriage, or we could equally speak about the Affordable Care Act, this was the moment in this country in which the national policy would be determined. So at that moment, it is definitely going to bring out the most strong advocates who want to put out their position as effectively as they believe they can. What I think is most interesting in both of those decisions at the Supreme Court is in the post after the decision came down, there are very few examples around the country of uncivil behavior on either side, gloating on the side that won, if you want to look at it that way, or in fact attacking back for people whose deeply held beliefs, often connected to their religious beliefs, feel that this was the wrong decision. I think it's been impressive that across the country, the dialogue has gone on after the decision in ways that are, frankly, mostly civil.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn, a couple more questions for you, and this is based on the presidential race coming up. We're getting ready for this next presidential campaign. Already have more than 15 declared candidates when we combine the Republicans and Democrats. Already insults being tossed around. Do you expect the candidates to at least try to have civil exchanges on things?
Unfortunately, we know that negative campaigning is one of the primary tools in the political consultant's handbook, and I think we can assume that this election, given just the rampant amounts of money, will have a tremendous amount of negative advertising. And, Steve, what concerns me the most about that, and there's plenty of poll data to support what I'm about to say, it really turns Americans off. Americans are sick to death of negative campaigning. Even though we know there's research to show that it does influence how they vote, it is depressing vote. You know, in 2014, when the research was completed, in the United States, we had the lowest voter turnout since 1837. Wow. Not since World War II, which is what most people talked about, but since 1837. So Americans are sick of what happens in campaign cycles, the amount of money spent, how uncivil it is. How do you expect a candidate to work amicably across the aisle when the other parties just spent a whole campaign cycle trying to tear down their characters? So I don't hold out a lot of optimism that we'll see much different in the presidential campaign. But I would like to say,
sure,
if I can,
please,
one of the programs that we're doing that I think is extremely, really good sign in terms of what may come down the road in a decade or so. We have a program called Next Generation, Steve, that works only with state legislatures. So this is where a state legislature has invited our institute. We call the program Next Generation. And we come into the legislature and we actually offer a workshop called Building Trust Through Civil Discourse. To date, we've done this in 12 states, 235 legislators, and we have 21 more states who are talking to us about doing this. So people at the state level are more responsive to the cry they hear from the public around that they're really tired of watching elected officials eviscerate each other. So we, in August, are actually launching a national network of these state legislators. So a woman from Colorado who's going to run for Congress in 2016 happens to be a Democrat. A man from Washington happens to be a Republican who's going to run in his district in 2016. Through our network, we're already making it possible for these state legislators to meet each other, to work together, so that by the time they get to D.C., by the time they're walking in the House of Representatives or in the Senate, they actually are already practicing these principles of civility and problem solving.
And good, so again, great luck with that effort, Carolyn. I'm sorry I have to let you go. Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is Executive Director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, which is headquartered at the U of A in Tucson. Carolyn, thank you.
Steve, thanks for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with the chair of Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission about the Supreme Court's decision earlier this week. And then later on this hour, we'll talk with Paul Rubin of Phoenix Magazine about Maricopa County Prosecutor Juan Martinez. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Moores & Cabot Investments and D.N. Griebel in their Mesa branch. Moores & Cabot is a 125-year-old national wealth management firm that is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Stay with us for BBC News Hour today at 1. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now on the southbound Loop 303 freeway in the West Valley, there's a crash on the Bell Road on-ramp. Around the state right now, sunny skies, 90 degrees in Tucson. It's 90 in Casa Grande, 81 in Prescott, 78 degrees in Flagstaff, sunny and 92 in Yuma. A special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Jessica Jones and Richard Taylor, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. Partly sunny skies in the valley, 94 degrees at 11:26.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Arizona voters approved the state's Independent Redistricting Commission, which called for the drawing of congressional and legislative maps to be taken away from state lawmakers. When the first commission's maps were drawn, there was some frustration and hand-wringing. But once the second collection of maps was put together after 2010, frustration from a different group of people, mostly Republican legislators, led to lawsuits. Earlier this week, the U.S. Supreme Court dashed the hopes of those who wanted to give the congressional maps back to lawmakers when a majority of justices said the Independent Redistricting Commission was constitutional. Colleen Coyle Mathis is the chair of the commission and joins me for a few minutes. Colleen, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Nice to have you with us. So how important was the court's ruling on the IRC?
It was very important. The stakes were higher than I would have liked, frankly. I'm very pleased with the court's decision, of course, and very proud of the Arizonans who had the foresight back in 2000 to implement independent redistricting in the state.
Have people gotten the wrong impression that a commission with the word independent in it would be free of politics?
Yes, in my opinion, yes. And I'm glad you asked that question. We are called the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission. But that word independent doesn't mean that politics is entirely removed from the process. In fact, I would argue that you can't remove politics entirely from the process because this is a political activity that we're conducting, and the commission is made up of 80% partisan. So it's very difficult to remove politics from the process. And independent really refers to just being independent of the legislature. That's what the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission is. It's independent from the legislature.
Colleen, the commission has been hit hard in a concrete way, obviously, in terms of lawsuits, but also in kind of personal ways. Have you felt like a pincushion for criticism at times, and did that ever affect the work of the commission?
Well, yeah, some people have compared me to a pinata at times, okay. But and it has felt that way sometimes. But, you know, ultimately, it's been a really great process. I think redistricting in general is a very contentious thing, and independent redistricting doesn't remove that contentiousness. So that's going to be part of the mix.
Some people, and I mentioned it a couple minutes ago in the introduction, that when the first commission was put together, certainly there were complaints. When the second commission drew its maps, there was a feeling that there'd been some maneuvering by one party versus another and whatnot, and we talked about the politics of this thing. Do you think all that stuff got people distracted from what the real work of the commission was intended to be?
Maybe for some, but for me, I just knew I needed to keep this commission going down the tracks and keep things between the telephone poles, so to speak. So that's really what I worked hard to do, was try to achieve consensus when we could, but ultimately I had to vote my conscience, and that's what I did.
Did you expect this kind of, I don't want to say vitriol, but just this kind of intensity tied to this process, especially once the maps had been drawn, once you'd gone through that hard work and worked with the map makers and whatnot? Did you expect it to still carry on? We're in 2015 now.
Right, I did. Well, our previous commission in Arizona experienced a lot of litigation, too, I think all the way up until either 2009 or 2010, so almost a decade. So I did expect litigation to occur with our commission as well.
Bob Robb, Arizona Republic columnist today, actually wrote in today's paper that the IRC, in his opinion, hasn't had really that much of an impact in terms of the changes, in terms of creating more competitive districts, except for when it comes to, obviously, that has changed a little bit. But overall, this still seems to be a state that is dominated by one party. What are your feelings about that? Did you feel like the work of the commission accomplished its goals? Do you feel good about what was accomplished, regardless of the results at election time?
Yes, I do feel really good about what the commission accomplished. It has to comply with a number of different criteria as it draws its lines, and those criteria are often competing with each other. And so you really have to achieve a balance among all the criteria, and that's what the commission worked really hard to do. And the outcome, we essentially ended up drawing 4 safe Republican districts, 2 safe Democratic districts that are due to the Voting Rights Act that we have to comply with, and then 3 competitive districts. Arizona was fortunate in that it got an additional district under our commission due to population growth. And so while some, you know, feel like we didn't draw enough competitive districts, at the end of the day, once you deal with all the criteria, there's only so many independents, Republicans, and Democrats to have among your districts. And so I think achieving 3 was great. And, you know, Arizona has some of the most competitive races in the country now. A lot of people say there's only 35 nationally out of 435 seats that are competitive. And if we've got 3 of those, and I think that's really something for Arizonans to be proud of.
Colleen, what do you think you've learned about all this? I mean, I don't know much about your background. I'm not saying we're a political novice in any way, because you probably were not. But when you actually get into the midst of this, what do you think you learned about how the electoral process works, about how commissions like this work? Can you give us some insight on that?
Well, I am not an attorney, but I've gotten to know a lot of them through this process. That's one thing I've learned is I think, you know, having a legal background is helpful, but I also don't feel like I was hindered in any way, because I think I'm good at listening to folks, and that's a big part of this is really trying to engage as many people as you can in this process and get them to tell you what it is that they value. And then all we can do is try to represent those ideas expressed to us as best we can, while still following all the criteria that are outlined for us in the Arizona Constitution.
Colleen Coyle Mathis is the chair of the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, which, thanks to the Supreme Court, still exists. Colleen, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Steve.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. So now that the Supreme Court has declared the Independent Redistricting Commission constitutional, what does that mean for elections in Arizona going forward? To talk about that, I'm joined by NAU political scientist Fred Solop. Fred, good morning.
Good morning.
So was the Supreme Court's decision potentially good news for voters as you read it?
Absolutely. This is a message that voters matter, that we don't want state legislatures deciding how our districts are going to look in Arizona, and the people have made that statement. They voted for an independent redistricting commission that's been upheld. So I think this is a very good message for voters.
And what about the impact of the decision outside of Arizona? Do you expect other states now to try to create their own commissions?
Well, first, there are roughly 12 other states with something similar. California certainly was looking at this decision, and many states were nervous. So they know that they can keep their independent process intact. So that's a very positive message for other states. But I think other states are going to look at this and consider going in this direction. We're starting to see a backlash against partisanship and partisan politics in the United States. We're seeing a backlash against big money being spent in politics. And this is will just fuel the interests of people who want to get those partisan forces out of politics and return power to the people.
And having just talked with Colleen Coyle Mathis, one of the things that she got criticized for over and over again, being the independent and the chair of the commission, was that, well, it was clear people looked into her background, and her husband was this, or she actually leaned this way. Does something like that make it less likely for qualified, dedicated people to want to be on a commission like that?
Well, I think on the surface, no, that this is supposed to be an independent process, and we need good people like Colleen Mathis stepping up and getting involved. But what happened in Arizona is very shameful. The Republicans especially just attacked this commission from day one. They challenged who was on the initial list of possible appointments. They've attacked who was hired as lawyers. They attacked who was hired as a consultant on the mapping. They went after individuals like Colleen Mathis. They just, from day one, the Republicans in the state legislature just went after this commission. And the irony is that it's an independent redistricting commission that people want to get partisan politics outside of the system. And partisan politics really try to influence the system quite heavily. So I applaud people like Colleen Mathis coming forth and standing strong and doing a good job.
Fran, I think one of the challenges, too, for outsiders who look at the process is voters approve the commission. The commission is a separate entity. But when we look at registration numbers and how they're changing, certainly independents are on the rise dramatically. But we're still, I mean, you're a political scientist. You and I have discussed this in the past. How do you define independents? That can be hard. But meanwhile, Republican registration has stayed relatively steady in the state, but Democratic registration has dropped a lot. So it can be hard, I think, to balance people looking at it saying, well, here's a commission which is designed to do something and take politics out of the process. And then you have Republican legislators who say, well, wait a second, we have this huge advantage. We'd like to draw those maps. Why shouldn't we be able to do that? It does seem like kind of a convoluted scenario, doesn't it, in some ways?
Well, it is a convoluted scenario, and fundamentally it's about the rules. It's a contestation over the rules, and we know the rules matter. If the rules shift in one direction or another, it's going to change who gets elected to office. The Republicans are going to benefit, or Democrats are going to benefit. Or, ideally in the future, given the rise of independent voters, independents will benefit. So this is fundamentally about the rules, and people will always be contesting the rules. It is ironic that the Republicans control the legislature, even though independents have a larger number of registrants in the state, and the Republicans are going to hold on to their power. And that was part of the reason that they attacked this commission. They were unhappy that there were three competitive congressional districts established in Arizona. On the surface, it seemed to weaken the Republican power. And they were unhappy with this. They tried to influence the process, and they're going to continue to try to influence the process to preserve the power. What they also know is that demographics are not on their side. We have a rising population of Latinos who tend to vote Democratic when they vote. A lot of the more senior Republican voters are going to not be defining the system very much longer as generations of younger voters replace the older voters. So demographics are not on the side of the Republicans, and they're going to continue to fight to maintain their power.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with NAU political scientist Fred Salop. Fred, though she has, or her people have said publicly this isn't the case, do you think Representative Ann Kirkpatrick may regret declaring for the U.S. Senate race now?
Well, Ann Kirkpatrick has declared for the U.S. Senate race, and she has an uphill battle to win that seat. I think she still has an opportunity. Now the Supreme Court has weighed in, she has an opportunity to rethink that decision. Nothing's final yet, and she could still come back and look at CD1 as a safe seat. Otherwise, this becomes an open seat in a competitive district. It was one of the most expensive races in 2014, and it will be one of the most expensive races in 2016. But Ann Kirkpatrick has an opportunity to come back and hold on to the seat.
And do you think she might do that? And would voters look at that askance?
I think she must be just considering that as part of the decision-making calculus on her part. I don't think voters would be troubled if she decided to stay with CD1. She would need to explain why she initially threw her hat into the ring for the Senate seat, but is coming back. And I think voters would be very willing to accept that.
Fred, if she does decide to stay in the Senate race, are there certain candidates you're watching closely? It was really not that close a race when Ann Kirkpatrick beat former Arizona House Speaker Andy Tobin in the last go-round. Are there certain candidates you think are interesting possibilities for that seat?
Well, it's it is a very interesting seat. Ann Kirkpatrick won last time around with about 53% of the vote. The previous election, she won with only 48% of the vote, less than a majority. It is a competitive district. Republicans know that they can do well in this district if they choose the right candidate. Certainly, Andy Tobin's a leading candidate, given that he was the front runner last time around for the Republican Party and ran a credible race. But given that it's an open seat, many people will be looking at this and trying to weigh their fortunes and their futures.
Fred, finally, yesterday the Supreme Court said it'll look at a case in its next term involving the drawing of Arizona's legislative districts by the commission. How closely are you watching that? What's the potential impact to come out of that?
I am watching that closely, and that's a little different case. It's not simply about whether the Independent Redistricting Commission has the power to make decisions. It's more about how they made their decisions and whether minority voters were put into one district or another. It's a very important case for the Supreme Court to take up. They've also taken up a Texas case in the next legislature or the next term to look at this question of one person, one vote. Should it be one citizen, one vote, one voter, one vote? How do we look at the population of these congressional districts? So the Supreme Court has said that they are going to continue to focus on redistricting issues, and that's quite important for political scientists, especially because we're fundamentally concerned with the rules of the game, how the rules of the game are constituted, and who benefits, who does not benefit from those rules.
NAU political scientist Fred Salop. Fred, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good talking to you again.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the Supreme Court's ruling on same-sex marriage. How does that affect LGBT issues going forward? Plus, journalist Paul Rubin has written a profile of Juan Martinez, the prosecutor for Phoenix Magazine. We'll learn more about that coming up next. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Essence Bakery, located in Tempe and now 3830 East Indian School, featuring breakfast, organic lunches, and specialty pastries, including French macaroons and croissants. More information at EssenceBakery.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now on the southbound Loop 303 freeway in the West Valley, watch out for a crash on the Bell Road on-ramp. Well, you should be able to get your outside activities in today. It'll be hot, but not as hot as it's been, with a high expected today of 105. We're looking for 107 tomorrow and 109 on Friday. NPR's Here and Now starts at 12 o'clock. President Obama has announced the U.S. and Cuba will reopen their embassies in Havana and Washington. It's a major step in restoring diplomatic relations. And what's it like to work someplace where almost no one has a title and anyone can be the leader? That's Here and Now from Boston, starting at noon. Partly sunny skies right now in Phoenix and 94 degrees at 11:43.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last week's Supreme Court ruling legalizing same-sex marriage in the U.S. caused some to despair and many others to celebrate. But LGBT activists say same-sex marriage doesn't even come close to erasing other discrimination that exists, including in employment and housing. Madeline Adelman is an associate professor in justice and social inquiry at ASU and on the local board of the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, or GLSEN. Madeline, is there a concern the joy over the Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage could slow efforts to overcome other aspects of LGBT discrimination?
So first, I'm just thinking, I was born in 1967. Which is the same year that Loving v. Virginia was decided by the Supreme Court, just a few months before I was born. So I was born into a place, interracial marriage was legalized, which means that for some people it was still culturally unacceptable, but the law was following the majority of the country at the time. And so here we are, I'll say 47 years later, and I have a young niece who was just born 3 months ago, and she'll be born now into a place, a time, where same-sex marriage is legal and culturally acceptable to the majority of the people in this country, although not by everyone. So it's nice to kind of take stock of how long it takes to create change, but how meaningful it can be.
What do you think it says about our society that a majority are in favor of this, or at least accepting of it? Do you think there's progress in that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you just look at the polls, you can see significant shifts over time. with the number of people who not only support same-sex marriage, but actually already think that we have non-discrimination laws. Here in Arizona, I was just looking up this morning, 73% of people here in Arizona think that we already have anti-discrimination laws based on actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. And that's with regards to workplace, housing, and what we call public accommodations, you know, when you buy stuff and stay places.
What's the danger of that? Is there danger in that? That is it harder to change minds if people think it's already in effect?
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about this. You know, I'm an anthropologist, and so we think, what's the relationship between law and culture? And on the one hand, when people think that there's a norm, when people generally follow them, whether or not that norm has been legalized or codified can sometimes make more people pay attention to it, and it can also make it a bigger deal when they don't. So on the one hand, the fact that we've got 73% of people, almost three-quarters of people here in Arizona, think that it's illegal to discriminate against people based on their sexual orientation or maybe their gender identity, that's kind of fabulous if they have internalized that understanding. So we actually need the law to help people remember that it exists and to enforce it when it doesn't.
Again, going back to the same-sex marriage being made legal, do you think those who are opposed to that or were opposed to that in general or for some reason have issues with people who are homosexual or whatever it may be, do you think that's going to make them fight even harder for some of these laws to change, these anti-discrimination laws?
I think there's always going to be a small percentage of people who feel embattled on either side. You know, there are some people who are... okay, fine, we've got marriage, now what? We got more work to do. And there's people on the other side who are appalled that this decision came down the way it did. And they will continue to fight, and so be it. What's great is that when you work on these issues and you're working on them in the public square, so for example, I do a lot of work in schools. The school is an example of our public square. It's where people come together. And when we are fighting for legal changes in schools, it applies to everyone. Now, if people don't want to participate in that public square, they don't have to. And that's what's great about our country, right? So if people choose to remove their students from school, which would be a shame, but they can choose to do so. Mm-hmm. And so there might be a very small, I'll call it extreme percentage of people who will decide to opt out. But what's great is the rest of us who automatically opt in will have the benefit of the kinds of rights and responsibilities that we're now talking about. The work that we have to do might not be as obvious. So we still actually have a no promo homo policy here in Arizona for our HIV/AIDS education. Mm-hmm. And so the kind of logical result of a marriage equality decision is to say, okay, how does this kind of trickle down and affect all different parts of our public life? Well, in public schools, we have a statute that says that you can't, quote unquote, promote homosexuality as a lifestyle in our schools, just for HIV/AIDS education for however many minutes that is during the day. I think this decision might have people questioning the utility, the logic of that kind of policy. It might have people changing and thinking about our sexual health education policies, because not everyone is going to want to get or be married. The marriage equality statute allows people to choose to get married. Most people in the United States, the majority live alone in their homes. So we got to think about how the marriage equality law from the Supreme Court creates opportunities, but also doesn't, we don't want it to hide the work that has to be done.
Mm-hmm. What's your biggest concern at this point as far as the next step that should be taken? Is there the concern that if you happen to be gay, you could get fired at your job for being gay, for example?
So I think there's a few different areas, and what's wonderful about social movements is you don't have to always choose. People go in some different directions, and it's great when they coordinate their efforts. Sometimes they coordinate their message, but not always. So we've had people for decades working on employment discrimination, people working on transgender health and rights, people working on youth and safe schools, and that work will continue. Here in Arizona, we already have now a coalition called Competitive Arizona, and they are moving forward to help ensure that employment, housing, and public accommodation are barred from discrimination for sexual orientation and gender identity expression. The work that we're doing in schools has to continue as well, because the anti-LGBT discrimination, violence, exclusion has been there before the marriage equality decision, and it's going to be there afterwards, in part perhaps because of some backlash. It's unclear. Well, time will tell.
Are people steeled for more fighting? When you've had, I mean, for some people, it seems like, oh my gosh, this happened overnight. It did not happen overnight. People were working for years and years and years, And now one battle, perhaps, if you want to put it that way, mm-hmm. is won, but there's still more work to be done. Does this help people feel better about the society in which they live so they'll want to say, hey, we can make more progress in this, or, whew, I need a break?
Yeah, I think organizations across the country are having that conversation about, first of all, what's next and how to do it. And at the underneath all that is, how are we going to fund it? Social change takes money. So I think what's important for people to realize is that for all that they've donated and given and participated for marriage equality, we need that and more to continue the fight. And that includes fighting for the right for students to enter a school and have it be fully funded when they get there. Mm-hmm. And regardless of their sexual orientation and gender identity expression, those mm-hmm. things all come together in a package to make a school or another kind of public space a place where everyone can become themselves and be themselves and transact business. So I think that's why people are going to be more and more excited about supporting this cause.
When you mention transacting business, it makes me think about whether motive matters. If businesses decide, even if they were not consciously discriminatory, but if they decide it is definitely against our best interest to be discriminatory from a financial point of view, is that okay? Is that a starting point?
Yeah, I think that it kind of brings us back to the relationship between law and culture. So whether or not you in your bones and in your values feel like that's the right thing to do, well, that's up to you. And that might happen. But in the meantime, that student gets the inclusive curricula. They get the Gay Straight Alliance. They get the educator who is a role model and a supporter. Mm. And that's what matters in the meantime.
Madeline Edelman is an associate professor in justice and social inquiry at ASU. She's also on the local board of the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, or GLSEN. You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The recent Jody Arias murder trial received a lot of national attention, which also led to the case's prosecutor Juan Martinez being in the spotlight. In some ways, Martinez's style is reminiscent of intense theatrical prosecutors you might see on TV or in movies. In the July issue of Phoenix Magazine, award-winning journalist Paul Rubin covers Martinez from a number of angles and gets perspectives on him from allies and adversaries. And Paul Rubin joins me now. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Everyone but Juan, who wouldn't cooperate with the profile, though he was very gracious in saying, go ahead and just do it without me.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Is that because of the position he's in as a county prosecutor, or did he just really not want this profile?
Well, you know, it's hard to know. I bumped into him while in the process of doing the story, and we had a great chat, and I said, so what's the deal? And he said, well, you know, it's the office doesn't really want me to do this at this particular point. But I know Juan really well personally, and I know that he doesn't shy away from publicity, so I'll just maybe get Juan on someday and ask him why he didn't cooperate, but it was okay.
I won't pursue this too much more, but yeah, he does seem like a guy who's a self-promoter. I suppose the politics of the office may have gotten in the way, right?
Yeah, he's been all over the place. I mean, the Arias case, which was a case that I suspect that many of your listeners, and I know for myself, I tried everything I could do to avoid.
You called that correctly, Paul, yes.
Did I? Good. Well, you know, it was a case that I never wrote about when I was working at New Times before I was laid off a few years ago, and I stayed away from it whenever possible, and I'm still kind of baffled on how, what juice it got internationally, but Juan was Juan before Arias and will be Juan after Arias, and he was really, has been for a long time, a lightning rod inside the Maricopa County criminal justice system. And people love him, and people hate him.
Well, Paul, let's boil it down a little bit for folks who didn't watch the Arias trial and were not interested in that, because as you wrote in the article, he has been involved in other high-profile cases, though not as internationally high profile as this one. Who is Juan Martinez at his core, and how did he get to this position?
Juan has a great backstory. I mean, he's really a self-made guy, born in Mexico, came up living in pretty poor conditions, from what I understand, Texas, self-educated until he decided he wanted to make something of himself, and he surely has. I mean, he's really a hard worker. He's very well prepared in the courtroom. The courtroom is his stage. He's a natural in there. He works hard. That much said, he has a side to him, which I describe in the story, which Phoenix Magazine was kind enough to give me a lot of space. We thank the editor, Craig Outier, for that. But he really has this little part of him. He can't help himself. He tends to bully people that he doesn't have to bully. And, you know, you can bully Jodi Arias because she's the defendant and she's the bad guy. But he tends to work at one speed, which is basically off with the head.
Has that made him an effective prosecutor or just a high-profile prosecutor?
Oh, he's been effective. I mean, you know, most of the time, like the Arias case was certainly no whodunit. It was a slam dunk. And, you know, the big issue in that case was going to be whether she got life in prison without parole or the death penalty. And as you know, she got life in prison without parole. But, you know, he's been very successful. I mean, I said earlier, he works hard. He's ready to go. And he's had success in numerous cases. He's got a bunch of people on death row. But he's not, you know, he's not all that in terms of, you know, the Arias case, in a sense, was a loss for him. She didn't get death. I mean, as odd as that sounds. And the Doug Grant Mormon murder case, which we called it, was another case in which things didn't turn out like Juan expected. But he's very formidable in the courtroom.
Paul, you do cite at least one juror in the piece who says that there was one example where Juan's theatrics were almost like, well, he didn't really need to do that. So it, in a way, sort of turned them off. They sort of felt like, I mean, can he just not help himself sometimes?
Sometimes is being kind. He all the time. But he's, you know, he works kind of, you know, old school guy. I mean, he works with big yellow notebooks and he writes on them. He has a near photographic memory for dates, times, and places. And if you don't, you know, he's short in stature, but he reminds me of a middle linebacker, like the guy, I can't remember his name, the guy who plays for the Detroit Lions, who's always getting in trouble for dirty play. And, you know, I mean, he'll roll over you, and he'll roll over judges, intimidate judges, and he'll take over the courtroom. And sometimes, you know, when you have a real bad guy and the jurors at the end of the day say, yeah, we really enjoyed Juan. But in the Arias case, Steve, it was just bizarre that he became kind of like, you know, the groupie factor that, you know, Mr. Wonderful and all that was, for those of us who've been around the courtroom, in my case, for the last 35 years up here, it was just flat out strange.
Yeah, I mean, and Paul, you've been in the business a long time. I mean, very little phases you, but when we're talking about a serious murder case like this and people are on social media sort of ogling the prosecutor, did it seem weird to you?
Weird, yeah. It seemed very odd to me. And the response I've gotten from the story, which has been, I can't say favorable. I mean, I've gotten numerous emails from people that just have this obsession. We still have this obsession, almost all of them women, with Jodi Arias and how evil she is. And that by proxy, me writing anything critical about Juan, it makes me almost, you know, one step short of a Jodi Arias type of person. I mean, it's like, you know, I've gotten some nasty stuff. And then on the other side, the defense bar, I've gotten letters from and emails and texts from a lot of my friends in the defense bar who thought I wasn't tough enough on Juan. And they would like him probably strung up like the Arias haters would like her strung up.
Well, then you should be a proud journalist, Paul. You're getting it from both sides, right? So that's perfect.
Well, I didn't feel strongly both ways, but I actually do have respect for Juan on a lot of levels. We get along fine personally, though. He is a very troubling character inside that system, which is the system is dependent on people doing ethical work, and sometimes he was right on the edge of that word ethical.
Yeah, and just a couple minutes left, Paul. Let's delve into that a little bit more, because it seemed like there were a lot of people who were adversarial toward him. And do you think that's legit, or is there some sour grapes there as well?
Well, no, I think it is legit. And you know, that was a story in reporting the story out that people wanted to say all kinds of nasty stuff about Juan, and I said, well, I might quote you, but I got to quote you by name. Then they'd back off, and so I said, well, sorry, no quote. But there were several people, as you mentioned, you know, former U.S. Attorney for Arizona Mel McDonald, who's gone up against Juan several times, and other people who were quoted in the story with, I mean, really strong anti-Juan quotes. And it was a lot easier to find those than people who wanted their name attached to Juan as, you know, Mr. Superstar. Mm.
Paul, I need a short answer on this one, but a quote at the end of your story calls Martinez shrewd and a survivor.
Yeah.
Is he going to survive? Do you think he's going to stay at the county attorney's office, or has he become such a star that maybe his head is too big for the office?
No. I think he will be with that office for a bit. He loves trial work, and though he denied it to me in our one-on-one conversation, I think he foresees himself as a future Nancy Grace, which is a scary thought.
Do we need another one of those, Paul? That's the big question.
No, we don't, Steve. And thank you so much for having your show, which is actually a much different attitude.
Award-winning journalist Paul Rubin covers prosecutor Juan Martinez in the July issue of Phoenix Magazine. Paul, always a pleasure to catch up. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. Take care. Bye-bye.
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on the program. And thank you very much for listening. If you missed our conversations with Paul Rubin or retiring Pima County Sheriff Clarence Dupnik or Independent Redistricting Commission Chair Colleen Coyle Mathis, you can listen to them later this afternoon at KJZZ.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone, catch some of our other interviews as well. Now it's time for NPR's Here and Now on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.